Another week and another episode from the show that tries to comfort you in your sleepless nights or your cold mornings with some interesting topics that delve into what seems to be those places that our minds don't wander to. But we always think about it unconsciously, though. In the last episode, I've talked about the Sandman comic book by Neil Gaiman, where I was very interested in some storylines that the Netflix TV adaptation showcased fantastically, like 24/7 with John Dee and Dream's Escape, and of course, the Eternal Waking Curse, as well as the fight between Lucifer and Dream. I've also talked about Dream's siblings and how they look like, hoping that one day I might make a second part of it. But this has got me thinking about a subject I wanted to touch on as well, which is the alternate name of Dream in the comics, Morpheus. I guess most people associate the name Morpheus with Lawrence Fishburne's iconic character from The Matrix, but it's actually a Greek name for the Greek god of dreams, meaning shaper of dreams, which is a word basically used everywhere. Morph, which means transforming in modern English, or its original meaning, shape, most infamously used with a morphine drug. And other concepts like morphogenesis, polymorphism, metamorphosis, etc. But as you can see, there are a lot of Greek/Roman words that are used in our everyday lives, and most of them derived from Greek gods and myths, which will be our tonight's subject. First of all, a fun fact about the podcast's name, Midnight's Insomnia. Insomnia is a Roman word coming from somnia, which means sleep, derived from the Roman god of sleep, Somnos, which is equivalent to hypnos in Greek. And this is a theme that you'll see throughout the concept of Greek versus Roman. Sometimes we use Greek in certain concepts and Roman in another concept as well, which are way more common than you might think. Now, since it's in no way easy to tackle this concept in an organized fashion, I wanted to first tell you about the history of Greek gods, how many generations we have, and the wars that happened, and some of the stories we still hear about these days. It should be interesting to tackle, but I want you to keep something in mind. There are several ancient sources that talk about these gods and myths, and sometimes they differ when it comes to who was the parent or who was the child of who. So in some cases, I'm making a choice on what I want to believe in all these myths, okay? So let's start this episode. Now, the first thing I want to talk about is the family tree, essentially, starting with the first generation of gods, the primordial gods. These deities represented the fundamental forces and physical foundations of the world and were generally not actively worshipped, as they, for the most part, were not given human characteristics. They were instead personifications of places or abstract concepts, to which almost everyone claimed that they originated from a single entity. Chaos. The first progenitor, the very first of all, the origin of everything, the empty, unfathomable space at the beginning of time. But it was more than just a gaping void, as its name is usually translated from ancient Greek. Personified as a female, Chaos was the primal feature of the universe, a shadowy realm of mass and energy from which much of what is powerful and mostly negative and dark in the world would stem forth in later genealogies. However, before we go deeper into the primordial gods, we have two very blurred out gods or personifications, being that they exist beyond space and time itself. Some say they were before even the universe was created, it being Chaos itself. Those two are Kronos, which is the personification of time itself. He was considered to have the shape of a three-headed serpent. The heads were those of a man, a bull, and a lion. And of course, you might already know this, but Kronos is a popular word used in things such as a chronometer, chronological order, or chronobiology. The second is his daughter, Ananke, the personification of necessity, fate, and inevitability. Her Roman name is Necessitas. Now, the rest of the primordial gods, starting with Gaia, known as Terra for the Romans, it being Earth itself, yes, the very same we're in. As well as Eros Elder, since there's another Eros which is associated with Aphrodite and most commonly known as Cupid in Roman. Eros is sometimes associated with Phanes or Protogonos, the root word for progenitor being the firstborn, which all of them are the personification of procreation. Now we go to Tartarus, which is sometimes associated as a personification and a place with which is a concept we're very familiar with to a certain extent. This is essentially hell in Greek myth. The deepest part of the underworld, it was where ferocious monsters and horrible criminals were banished, the sunless abyss below Hades, which we'll talk about a bit later. Erebus is our third primordial god coming from Chaos. Erebus is the personification of darkness and shadows itself. And lastly, our last primordial here, and my personal favorite, Nyx. Nyx is the personification of the night, as it engulfs everything that we know of, basically being the default setting of space. And she was so powerful, her being the mother of other entities, that even Zeus himself feared her. Her Roman name is Nox. Now, the last five primordial beings are what came out of Chaos. Now, the primordial gods concept can still be valid on each personification's children with one another. But just remember that there are five main beings originating from Chaos, which are Gaia, being Earth, Eros Elder, which is procreation, Tartarus, which is the underworld, Erebus being darkness, and Nyx being the night itself. Now, with Nyx and Erebus's union, them being two concepts of darkness would produce luminous offspring. Aether, the divine air, or as some saying, the personification of the bright upper sky and heavens. And Hemera, the day. Now, the Greek myth and explanation for having daytime and nighttime is that every evening, Hemera's mother, Nyx, drew her dark veil across the sky, obscuring the shining blue of the heavenly aether, and bringing night to earth. With each morning, Hemera dispersed her mother's mists, bathing the earth again in the light of aether. Later on her own, Nyx gives birth to other personifications, Moros being the impending doom. His Roman equivalent is Fatum. His brother, Thanatos, which is death itself. His Roman name is Mors. Fun fact, the iconic villain's name from the Marvel movies, Thanos, is taken from the Greek mythology. We also have Hypnos, the Greek personification of sleep that we talked about earlier in the episode, and other siblings such as Momos, personification of blame, Oasis, being the twin sister of Momos, and the personification of misery, depression, and suffering. But her Roman name is what's used in modern English, which is Miseria. There's also Nemesis, which is divine retribution. It's karma against mortals, if you may. And my childhood's crush, Eris. She's the personification of chaos, discord, and strife. Now you might ask, how was she my childhood's crush though? She was only shown in Sinbad, The Legend of the Seven Seas, one of the best animation movies of all time, an opinion that I will die with. She was voiced by the iconic Michelle Pfeiffer, where she was the main antagonist of the movie. She has an amazing smoky and liquid-like design, and she was such a memorable villain even though she appeared for only 7 minutes. Now lastly, Charon, the ferryman of the underworld, who carries souls of the newly deceased. The Greeks would place a coin in the deceased's mouth or two on the person's eyes, it being a fee for Charon to cross the souls of the dead across the river Styx that divided the world of the living from the world of the dead to face judgment. Those who weren't buried or couldn't pay the fee would let their souls roam for 100 years before crossing it. Furthermore, there is a lot more to Nyx's children. I've just cited the most popular concepts we live by. Finishing up Nyx and Erebus' offspring, we'll check what Tartarus and Gaia produced, and I can tell you here that it wasn't any personification like we've seen earlier. They're all essentially iconic monsters and myths we've heard about, or seen in popular media. Like the Cerberus, the three-headed dog that's guarding the gates of hell. The Hydra, a multi-headed snake that when decapitated it would grow two more heads, which was killed by Heracles, or most popularly named by the Romans, Hercules, as part of his 12 labors. The Chimera, part lion, part goat, with a snake-headed tail. And the infamous Sphinx, that had the body of a lion, the face of a woman, and the wings of a bird. That asked all travelers a riddle that they had to solve in order to pass. The riddle she asks is a famous one, which was, the creature that has one voice, but has 4 feet in the morning, 2 feet in the afternoon, and 3 feet at night. Anyone who struggled to answer was eaten by the monster. However, Oedipus managed to answer correctly. He replied, the man, who crawls on all fours as a baby, walks on two as an adult, and needs a walking cane when old. And it seems that there was a second riddle following the first, which was, there are two sisters, one gives birth to the other, who in turn gives birth to the first. Who are they? And the correct answer is day and night, two words that are both feminine in the Greek language. And those monsters I've cited originated from Echidna, a half-woman, half-snake creature in the Greek mythology, also known as the mother of all monsters, and her husband, Typhoeus, or more popularly, Typhon, literally meaning hurricane. He was considered the mightiest and deadliest monster in Greek mythology. He was the last son of Gaia and Tartarus, created as a last attempt to repel the Olympian gods from defeating the Titans during the Titanomachy, that we'll talk about a bit later. Typhon fought Zeus in a cataclysmic battle, sadly ending in Zeus being victorious, and trapping Typhon under Mount Etna. Typhon was a winged giant said to be so huge that his head brushed the stars. He was a man shaped from the waist up, with two coiled serpents in place of legs. He had 100 serpent heads for fingers, a filthy matted beard, pointed ears, and eyes flashing fire. He was basically a nightmare. Now, continuing with monsters, we'll be looking at Gaia here. Gaia gave birth to Uranus herself. Uranus, or Uranus, is the personification of sky and heaven. His Roman equivalent is Caelus, which the word celestial is derived from. He was, for a while, the ruler of the known universe. Now, essentially, Gaia and Uranus got married, which is just disgusting to say the least, but they had produced 18 children, 12 titans, being the second generation of Greek gods, and most infamously, the Cyclops, the one-eyed monsters, and the Hecatoncheires, which were monsters with 50 heads and 100 arms, which Uranus hated those so much that he hid them somewhere inside Gaia, to which she was so enraged that she planned to punish Uranus with the help of the 12 titans, Oceanus, god of the ocean, Tethys, goddess of the rivers and oceans, Hyperion, god of the light, and Theia, goddess of sight and vision. And those two produced Helios, the personification of the sun, and Selene, the personification of the moon, which the Roman names for these gods are Sol and Lunos, respectively, being the basis for the terms solar and lunar. Continuing with Titan number 5, Themis, the personification of law, justice, and divine order. On to number 6, we have Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory. For 7, we have Phoebe, which was the Titan goddess of the bright intellect. There's also Coeus, which was an obscure god, but was only important for his descendants. Iapetus, which was the personification of mortal life, and only important for his descendants as well. Then being Atlas, the god that carried the world on his shoulders, Prometheus, creator of man and the one that gave man fire, and Epimetheus, god of hindsight, that married the first woman, Pandora. Our 10th titan is Crius, the god of constellations, to which he's important a bit because of his two descendants. Nike, the personification of victory, it also being the name for the shoe brand, and Kratos, the Greek personification of strength, which is now attributed to the God of War game series, where he was a mortal and a direct son to Zeus. And our last two titans, Rhea, queen of the titans, mother of the Olympian gods, and goddess of female fertility, motherhood, and generation. Her Roman counterpart is Ops. And finally, Cronus. Not to be confused with Kronos, which is time itself. Cronus, god of the harvest, is the youngest of the Titans, and the one who led the rebellion against their father, Uranus, to which he castrated him. And from the blood of Uranus came the Furies, goddesses of vengeance, and in some sources, Aphrodite herself. His Roman equivalent is none other than Saturn, to which you'll see the planet was named after him as well as Uranus, but the rest of the planets were mainly named after the Olympian gods that you'll see in a second. After overthrowing his father, Cronus, for a brief period of time, was the ruler of all gods and men. But soon, he grew as tyrannical as his father, fearing rebellion. He imprisoned both the Cyclops and the Hecatoncheires again, like his father, and alarmed by a prophecy saying that he would be overthrown by one of his children. He started swallowing all of his children, except for the last son, that was saved by Rhea, it being Zeus, and after he was nurtured and grown enough to fight his father, he gave his father a vomit-inducing drink, to which he vomited each of his siblings, one by one, and gathered them to start a rebellion, thus starting the Titanomachy, Olympian gods versus the Titans. Zeus's siblings were Hestia, Demeter, Hera, Hades, and Poseidon. Zeus released the Hecatoncheires and the Cyclops from Tartarus and asked for their allegiance, to which they accepted, even going as far as creating the famous thunderbolts for Zeus. After a decade-long battle, the Olympians stood victorious against the Titans, and Zeus banished them to Tartarus. Now Zeus, along with his brothers Hades and Poseidon, divided the universe by drawing straws. Zeus won and became the king of the sky, as well as the ruler of all mortals and gods. Poseidon became the ruler of the seas, while Hades, who drew the shortest straw, became the ruler of the underworld. This was the dawn of the last generation of gods in Greek mythology. Zeus is the new god of the sky, god of thunder, and ruler of the gods. His Roman counterpart is Jupiter. Zeus is infamous with his affairs, which will become more prominent when we check his descendants. Now his poor wife, Hera, which is funnily an anagram of her mother's name, Rhea. She was the goddess of marriage and women, queen of the gods, and one of the six original Olympians. Since there are 12 Olympians, but only six originals. You feel me? Hera was frequently enraged by her husband's constant adulterous escapades, and she often went out of her way to punish his mistresses and illegitimate children. She had a particular hatred for Hercules, and famously orchestrated most of the hardships and tragic events of his life, including his famous 12 labors. Her Roman counterpart is Juno. Now, our third original Olympian is Demeter. Her Roman name is Ceres. She took her father's place, Cronus, as the goddess of the harvest. Now, the fourth Olympian is Poseidon, the violent and ill-tempered god of the sea, probably as famous as Zeus, especially for his trident that pop culture likes to use as a weapon for controlling the seas. He was also feared as the provoker of earthquakes and worshipped as the creator of the horse. His Roman name is Neptune, like the blue planet. Now, moving on to another Olympian, Hestia. She was the virgin goddess of hearth and the firstborn Olympian from Rhea and Cronus. She was pure and peaceful. However, since she always had to stay at home, tending the fireplace, Hestia is not involved in many myths. Consequently, at a later stage, she would be replaced in the pantheon with the much wilder Dionysus. And now Hades, last of the first six born Olympians. However, he's technically not an Olympian since he tended to his realm. He's the god of the underworld, the place where human souls go after death. In time, his name became synonymous with his realm, unsurprisingly, since he barely left it. Appropriately, the most significant myth related to Hades concerns one of the very few times he did, to abduct Demeter's daughter Persephone, which in turn caused the seasons we know and love. And I guess it's time for another myth and explanation by the Greeks. So, essentially Hades, the ruler of the underworld, decided that he wanted to marry Persephone, his sister Demeter's only daughter. One day, as she was gathering flowers in the Nisaean meadow with her maidens, she wandered apart from the group ensnared by the sudden blooming of a glorious flagrant flower. Some say it was a narcissus. And she reached to pluck it. The ground below her feet opened and Hades, in his four-horse golden chariot, appeared before her in all his power and majesty. He snatched her and took her with him to the underworld to be his wife and queen. Needless to say, Demeter was not very pleasant when she found out from Hecate and Helios what had happened. Hurt and distraught, she started wandering aimlessly around and was aggrieved to such an extent that she neglected all of her duties. And since she was the goddess of agriculture and fertility, the earth was now barren, and people were dying of famine. Seeing no way out of it, Zeus, who some say must have approved Hades' abduction in the first place, sent Hermes, the messenger of the gods, to the underworld to fetch Persephone back to her mother. The divine messenger did do precisely that, and Demeter and Persephone were once again reunited on Olympus. However, either on her own accord or more probably after being tricked by Hades, Persephone had tasted one pomegranate seed before leaving the underworld. This, according to the ancient laws, obliged her to remain in the underworld. Zeus proposed a compromise. Persephone would spend two-thirds of the year with her mother and one-third with her new husband. Everybody agreed, and that's how the seasons were born and how the growth of crops was explained. Just like a seed, Persephone spends few months of the year below the earth. This is the period of Demeter's grief, which coincides with the dark winter months. But however, when the time comes for Persephone to go back to her mother, Demeter brings back the light and the warmth, and the earth rejoices in abundance. Hades' Roman name is Pluto, just like our very, very, very far dwarf planet. It's a nice story, in my opinion, explaining how the seasons came to existence. Moving to the rest of the Olympians, we first have Athena, goddess of wisdom and war, was the daughter of Zeus by an oceanid called Metis. She rose from her father's head fully grown and in full battle armor. She was the adored patroness of the city of Athens, named appropriately after her. She was also a virgin, as you may have known that Zeus would have sex with anyone and anything living or breathing. Just like Artemis and Hestia, Athena was never swayed by love or passion. Consequently, she never had any children. She played a big role in the Iliad, one of two major ancient Greek epic poems attributed to Homer, second being the Odyssey. Her Roman equivalent was Minerva. Next, we have the twins, Apollo and Artemis. Apollo is the new god of the sun, light, music and poetry, healing and plagues, prophecy and knowledge, order and beauty, archery and agriculture. One of the most versatile of the Greek gods in terms of domains. He's the son of Zeus, just like Athena. His Roman name is the same as his Greek. And now, his twin sister, Artemis, the new goddess of the moon, hunt, and wilderness as well. Her Roman name is Diana. Now talking about Hermes, like the popular apparel company. He's the messenger of the gods, god of travel and thieves. He was the only Olympian capable of crossing the border between the living and the dead. And in some myths, he was the inventor of speech, since the science of interpretation is known as hermeneutics. He is said to have created the lyre, and he has a winged helmet, most famously associated with a caduceus, a staff that has two intertwined snakes. Not to be confused with the rod of Asclepius, which was associated with Asclepius, the Greek god of medicine and physicians, naturally since he is the son of Apollo. The rod is famously used in all medical and healthcare. The difference between the rod and the staff is having a single snake in the rod of Asclepius. Hermes' Roman counterpart is Mercury, like the planet closest to the sun, it being very fast as well. Now finally, the last three Olympians. Now starting with Ares, the Greek god of war, violence, and brutality. He was the son of Zeus and Hera. He was loved neither by gods nor men, that is, with the exception of Aphrodite, another Olympian, who she bore with him many children, most famously the twins Phobos, which literally means fear, and is used in modern language as a suffix for a fear of something, like hydrophobia, claustrophobia, algophobia, and xenophobia, and his brother Deimos, translated into the word terror, both accompanying their father in battle. Ares' Roman counterpart is Mars, which is the closest planet to us, named Mars, of course, because of its red color. Now for the lovely Aphrodite. She is the Olympian goddess of love, beauty, sexual pleasure, and fertility. Her birth is still up to debate, as some said she was born from the blood of Uranus after he was castrated by his son Cronus, and some said that Aphrodite was one of Zeus's children. She was infinitely desirable by men and women alike, and infinitely out of reach. She was married to Hephaestus, however she had an affair with all the Olympians except for Zeus and Hades. Her name gave us the word aphrodisiac, while her Roman name, Venus, gave us the word venereal, as in venereal diseases. And Venus was also named after the planet after Mercury. And lastly, Hephaestus, craftsman and blacksmith of all the Olympians, and god of fire, invention, and volcanoes, as evident by his Roman name, Vulcan. He was an ugly god, and had the luck to be married to Aphrodite herself. Now, since Hestia isn't an Olympian, she got replaced by Dionysus, god of wine, festivity, ecstasy, and madness. He was the youngest Olympian, and the only one born from a mortal mother, by the one and only Zeus. And now I see the Greek god myths as folk tales, or comic book ideas most of the time. Although the interesting stories aren't that many, you have to give credit where it's due, since we're using a lot of Greek names and such almost on a daily basis. But I wanted to add a few more myths and stories that I absolutely loved, because they have meaning and lessons in them. We'll talk about King Midas' touch, Narcissus and Echo, Daedalus and Icarus, and Pandora's jar. Now, most interestingly is King Midas' story. King Midas was the not-so-smart king of Phrygia, who is today popularly remembered as the man with the golden touch. One day, some Phrygian peasants found a drunken old man in the garden's vicinity. After capturing him effortlessly, they brought him to their king. Midas recognized him almost immediately. He was Dionysus' oldest, wisest, and merriest reveler, the satyr Silenus. So, instead of punishing him, Midas welcomed him in his palace, where his servants fed and entertained him for no less than 10 nights. On the 11th, Midas personally took Silenus back to his master, Dionysus, who, in gratitude for Midas' hospitality, granted Midas one wish. Now, Midas could have asked for almost anything, but he opted for a somewhat strange, though at first sight also imaginative, thing. He asked Dionysus that he should be able to turn anything that he touched into gold. His wish was granted. Midas went away trying it out. He first turned some twigs into gold and then some stones. Afterward, he did the same to an ear of corn and some apples. There was no end to his rejoicing. Well, at least not until he got home and felt some hunger and some thirst. He suddenly realized that it was all but impossible to satisfy them. Both his food and his drinks turned into gold as well, the minute that they touched his mouth, his teeth, or his tongue. So Midas had no option but to go back to Dionysus and ask the god to take away his gift. "No problem," said Dionysus. "You just need to wash yourself in the river Pactolus." And he did exactly that. The legend ended nicely here. Some say his gift or curse didn't go away, and he touched his daughter, rendering her into gold as well, and driven mad because of the hunger and thirst. The lesson here was simple. Be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it. Secondly, the story of Narcissus and Echo. Narcissus was an extremely handsome youth. When he was an infant, some oracles prophesied that he would live a long life, but only if he never knew himself. The meaning of this prophecy only became clear years later. One day, Narcissus was in the woods, out hunting. The youngster was heartless and vain and spurned all those who were interested in him. On this day, a nymph saw him. Her name was Echo, and she had been cursed by Hera. Echo had covered for Zeus, Hera's husband, while he was out doing what he does best. Hera discovered that the nymph had tricked her, and now Echo can only repeat the words spoken to her. Instantly in love, she approached Narcissus but could only repeat what he said first. Narcissus, as yet could not see her, "Let us come together," he said. "Let us come together," she said back. She came out to greet him, but Narcissus rudely thrust her away. "I would rather die than allow you to make love to me," the vain hunter snapped, to which Echo only replied, "Make love to me." Narcissus stalked off, leaving Echo alone, still deeply in love. She pinned away until she had disappeared completely, leaving only her voice behind. She had literally became an echo. Still immensely arrogant, Narcissus sat down beside a mirror-like pool of water. He had never seen his reflection before, and looking into the pool, he did not recognize the youth looking back at him. He fell in love with his own reflection. Each time he reached for the other youth, he disturbed the water and the other man seemed to disappear. Narcissus had finally found someone worthy of his love, himself. Like Echo, Narcissus pinned away in hopeless love and died beside the pool. The story of Narcissus and Echo showed the damage that excessive vanity and self-love, what today is called narcissism, can have. Now onto another legend, Daedalus and Icarus. Icarus was the son of Daedalus, the craftsman who built the labyrinth, which was featured in the story of Theseus and the Minotaur. But after Daedalus aided Ariadne, Dionysus' wife, by telling her how Theseus could escape the labyrinth he designed, King Minos locked Daedalus and his son Icarus inside the maze. Ever the inventor, Daedalus fashioned some wings out of feathers and wax for him and his son to use to fly their way off the island of Crete. They escaped and flew up into the sky. Daedalus warned his son not to fly too close to the sun. Icarus got carried away and promptly did just that, upon which the wax in his wings melted. He fell to his death, drowning in the sea surrounding the island of Samos, a sea which is now named after him. As you may have noticed, this wouldn't be possible since gaining altitude from the ground, like going on a mountain, would result in extreme cold environments. But the nice thing about this myth was that it showed how hubris can send a person to their demise. Overreaching oneself would only have bad consequences. Now, lastly, Pandora's Jar, most likely known in all of pop culture as Pandora's Box. Pandora was the first mortal woman created, and not by Prometheus, since he's the creator of man. Pandora was made and molded by Hephaestus, the blacksmith of the Olympians. Her name, Pandora, means all gifts, which each god given a gift to her stored in a jar, not a box per se. However, that jar contained all evils imaginable, and she was instructed to never open it. But curiosity got the best of her, and she wanted to see what's inside, to which she opened it, and all of the evils that plague the world today, such as anger, lust, greed, envy, and many others, came pouring out. Shocked by what had happened, she quickly tried to put the lid back on, managing to merely trap hope inside it. That is why hope is the last thing that dies in humans. Even though deceitful from time to time, it is the only consolation humans have for all of the troubles Pandora let loose on the world. Men, who had been living well, now struggled to survive in a grim new world. This myth conveys the lesson that defiance of the gods will be harshly punished, but it also demonstrates that too much curiosity, heedless of consequences, can be a very bad thing. And as melancholic as it may seem, it shows that hope perseveres even in the darkest of times. Now, of course, these aren't the only Greek myths that happened. There are epic stories like the Odyssey, the Iliad, Achilles and the Trojan War, the Adventures of Perseus, which were adapted in the Rick Riordan books, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, and even got two movies realized from those novels, The 12 Labors of Heracles and even the unpopular myth of Air, which was used by Socrates himself to show that the choices people make have an impact on the afterlife. These stories are amazing, in my opinion. I've always had an interest on them rather than the other pantheon, like Norse myth, which was a bit too weird for me, not even trying to be realistic in any sense. But I only loved the concept they had for hell. They saw hell as an extremely cold place, not like the other pantheons having the same idea about hell. Nonetheless, I wanted to wrap this episode with some recommendations of other mediums you'd want to see the Greek gods portrayed in. Of course, first thing I'd recommend you all is the God of War game series, the original trilogy and the handheld games, which ended in a second Titanomachy, where Kratos, our protagonist, wages war against the Olympians. Another game I would say to take a look at is Assassin's Creed Odyssey. It's an amazing Greek-themed game, but it's a bad Assassin's Creed game. And it's a very big game, going through all of Greece and even going to war battles at times with Athenians versus Spartans in the Peloponnesian War. Another recommendation is the Percy Jackson movies, even though they're mostly teen drama with Greek elements, but the first movie is very nice in my opinion. You also have the Clash of the Titans movies. They're entertaining as well, and I would love to watch them back from time to time. I kind of hope that Greek gods and myths get the love they deserve, especially in games, since it's an amazing set of stories that can be translated beautifully in gameplay design and such. But I digress. Hopefully you didn't get bored by all of these stories and got excited, same as I did when writing this episode. Now I just want to take the time and tell you that, like Pandora trapped hope in her jar, hope never dies when you hold on to it. It's easier said than done for sure, but giving up isn't much of an option for you. You deserve better, and you owe yourself that much to reach those heights you want. You just need to run as best as you could to them. Thank you, Insomniacs, so much for listening, and hopefully, I'll see you in that better reality.